Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And we are here for three more episodes of Criminal Minds Season 7, including the episode that... I mean, is it okay to say that it made me turn on David Rossi forever? That I never forgave David Rossi after this episode of television? Is that too much?
No, I can understand why you would turn off, but he was a good Catholic boy.
Yeah, well, that's a conversation we can get into.
David Rossi, whoever writes David Rossi is anyway.
Yeah.
We'll get on to that when we get there.
Yeah. But first off, let's address episode 704.
Okay, Painless. When a Boise, Idaho principal dies days before the 10th anniversary of a high school massacre, the BAU attempts to track down an injustice collector determined to fulfill a vendetta against the survivors. Meanwhile, Hotch grows increasingly concerned about Jack following a parent-teacher conference, and Morgan and Reed engage in a prank war.
See, that's how you use a meanwhile. Because his Aaron's stuff with Jack and the prank war aren't related to the crimes. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's the most tangential possible relationship between the stuff with Jack and the crimes, but it really is just the most tenuous link possible.
Yeah.
So this is one of those episodes where my takeaway is, wow, this team is bad at keeping people alive. So it's like, a guy is blown up on the 10th anniversary of the of this famous school bombing and shooting, right? The principal is blown up.
Yeah.
And that weekend, they're having a get-together for various survivors of this thing. And not the team, not the cops, not anybody thinks, hey, maybe the survivors are being targeted. And we should keep an eye on them. Two different people die because they couldn't bother to keep a cop around to make sure that the other survivors were okay. Also, all the other survivors don't leave immediately the moment it's clear they're being targeted. Like, the principal... Actually, I was going to say, maybe you could give them the principal. No, you can't even say that they would write off the principal, because he was blown up! It's obviously a continuation of the school shooting. Why would anyone stay in town? And even if they did stay in town, why would the cops not be on them 24/7?
Do I have an answer for this conundrum?
Although, honestly, it started off with the principal's death. It was just so completely ludicrous that it's like he gets into his room and he puts a bomb in his clock, and then he wires the guy's phone so that when he dials 911, it will set off the bomb.
My question is, how did he get the principal's phone?
Really good question! More importantly, the principal, I don't understand why the principal dials 911 lying 3 feet away from the bomb. Like, yeah, I know your leg was shot and that hurts, but crawl further away from the bomb before you, like, start dialing people. Like, crawl to safety. You might say, well, it's hard to crawl to safety, blah, 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 blah. I guarantee this man has a bathroom not far away. Get into that bathtub and then call 911. Because guess what? You think that there's a timer of 2.5 minutes on that phone.
You've got 2.5 friggin' minutes.
That's
a long time.
That's plenty of time for you to just crawl right out of your house. And B, that's not enough time for the cops to get there. The cops can't get there in 2.5 minutes, but you can be out of your house in 2.5 minutes. So why are you calling them from the floor of the floor of the bedroom 3 feet away from your phone?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, I don't understand why they just don't... I mean, when the killer makes it clear, by bombing the principal that this is a continuation of the previous murders. Why aren't all, and first off, everyone involved, like all of the survivors are immediately A, potential victims, B, potential suspects, all of them.
Yeah. So, well, of course, you know, they would argue we're not going to be cowed by this. Duh.
Whatever they say. But the point is, they're immediately potential victims and immediately potential suspects. So it's the cops' job to have eyes on them 24/7 until you figure this out.
Yeah.
And yet, a bunch of them are able to just wander around. Oh, and one of them gets killed in the school while the FBI is there interviewing people? Oh, no, I guess it's a little later that night, but still, like, how are the cops not watching the school?
Why didn't they push that guy to tell the truth about what he was hinky about?
I know,
because like, they knew he was hinky about something, so why not find out what?
Why not find out why he's lying? Oh, you would have known who the killer was immediately.
Yes, it was too quick.
Oh, it was too quick. Oh, okay, so that's the reason they didn't do their jobs. Also, something I found really strange in this episode, like, just knowing how police investigations work, it's crazy to me that they didn't find the guy's hit list.
Yeah, give me a break.
Like, the way that the cops tear through people's houses after this kind of a thing has happened, like, it's just completely implausible to me that as they were tearing apart every part of these guys' life, this dead guy's life, they wouldn't have come across that note. Like, there's just no way. And it's like, they tear apart every little bit of your life when you've done this kind of thing, because they need to know why, and they need to know if anyone else was involved, and blah, 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 blah. And if literally just a book in the house had a hit list in between the pages... Of course they would have found that.
Particularly since that child did not have as many books back then when he was a little kid.
Of course not.
As he has now.
Oh, 100%. And the thing is, having the hit list back then, it wouldn't have told them anything.
No.
Like, it wouldn't have told them he had a partner.
But it would have been there when this happened.
Yeah. Because it turns out the death thing has nothing to do with the hit list in the end. It doesn't even help them solve the crime.
Nope.
Yeah, and it's like, so it takes them down a rabbit hole.
So
an investigative rabbit hole that doesn't really get them anywhere.
Yeah.
And then later they figure out this guy was lying about something and blah, 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 blah.
But they didn't follow up on it? Nope. Why wouldn't you follow up on it?
Yeah, because, like, right there, you know he's hiding something, and you just let him walk off, and you don't follow up. Even though, so there's a bombing going on. This guy has just started acting suspicious. You know he's lying about something.
Yeah.
And so either he has some information that could be relevant, or he's definitely the killer. Either way, don't just let him run off.
Yeah.
Like, the investigative techniques they do this week are bizarre, especially because 2 weeks in a row, they do the exact same thing that gets people killed, which is not bother to keep an eye on someone. But we'll talk about that second one in a minute.
Oh, yeah. And the funny thing is that I walked away after watching these three episodes going, well, they're better than last week's.
No, totally. Totally.
You know, I'm going... Well, they're better than last week's. I mean,
yeah, I can't debate that point. Although I will say, in stewing over my hatred over how much I loathe the episode Proof, I realize there is another episode as loathsome as Proof.
Okay.
The season 9 opener about the guy who, like, is obsessed with mantises and cut off a woman's head and tortures women and makes them eat flesh.
Oh, God.
And severed.
Oh, yeah. God. Please.
We're going to get there sooner rather than later. So I'm just saying there is an episode.
There is a problem right now with you rushing through these reviews so that we can be there for the end. It's because, you know, We're supposed to be watching these.
We are watching. No, no, I'm just saying it came up. It came up organically.
Yes, I know.
Organically, that there is an episode as loathsome as Proof, but I don't think that in all of the episodes since there has been an episode as loathsome as Proof after the season opener of season 9. So there you go. That's my one positive thing I'll have to say.
I'll have to go look at what was the episode season 9.
Well, I just told you, the one with the severed heads and the...
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm wondering who wrote it.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, you know, we're going to be talking about it in 8 weeks, so, you know. We'll have plenty of time to do research.
Called The Inspiration.
Yeah, and the second one is called The Inspired. I remember quite well.
Yeah, okay.
So loathsome. So it's interesting.
Oh, it's written by Janine Sherman Brerois.
Is that the same writer as Proof?
She's the one that wrote Proof.
No!
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, that's so perfect. Honestly, you heard me. I had no idea.
No idea.
I am blown away that it's the same writer. But now that I think about it, of course it's the same writer. You're a terrible person. Whoever you are.
Didn't I say she's the one doing Claws now?
Yeah, you're told. I think she's the one doing Claws.
Yeah, she's the one doing Claws.
Hey, maybe we never watch an episode of Claws.
Well, I did watch an episode of Claws.
Oh, we can talk about that later. But yeah, this episode, it's just so hard to watch because they don't do so many basic investigative things. Mm-hmm. Like, they just, all of the basic stuff they could do to try and figure this out, they just don't bother doing at all. Like, even after they know that there's a very clear suspect pool, a very small suspect pool, because apparently not many people are back in town for this anniversary.
No.
Like, it's this really small suspect pool. It would be very easy to keep an eye on them and try and find the killer, and they just don't do anything, because they think, oh, well, if we can just figure out why he's doing this, we'll be able to catch the guy. Yeah. But that's one of the things that you can use to figure out how to catch a guy. Another thing is, by knowing who he's going to target, and being there waiting. And instead of doing that, they focus on the why he's doing it, and two more people get killed, because they're so obsessed with trying to figure out the motive that they don't bother watching the obvious potential victims.
Which is why profiling is useless.
It's not only like useless at solving crimes, it actively gets people killed this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like they're so determined that profiling is going to be what solves the case.
Yeah.
That people get killed.
They ignore the actual evidence right in front of them. You know, victimology is important too. It's not just figuring out motives that solves these things. By the way, figuring out motives doesn't really solve the thing, because the guy blows. It's not like they figure out, I mean, yeah, they figure out who it is, but it doesn't matter that they figure out it is. He blew up a restaurant and stayed there holding people at gunpoint. They were going to catch him no matter what.
Yeah.
But they could have had him a lot earlier had they just, you know, been watching the people he wanted to kill, which they couldn't be bothered to do, because they had profiling to try and figure out. It's a frustrating episode.
Profiling was going to get them their answer.
I know, right?
The hell with police work.
Oh, God. Yeah. And so, I know that what do you call it? Reed gets him back, but this really is unprofessional bullying. Like the kind of stuff Morgan does. Like, it's done with a grin, and it's done where he's supposed to be charming. But
and David Rossi thinks it's cute.
I know.
If you want to know reasons to hate David Rossi.
Well, we're going to get some more, but yeah, David Rossi thinks it's hilarious. Jesus Christ. You know, it's like, no, you guys are supposed to be professionals working a case. And Derek has arranged it so every couple of minutes a reporter is going to call Reed, making him unable to focus and do his job.
Yeah.
Like, no, that's not professional. This is not a good thing to do. There are more serious things going on here than your need to just show off and be a bully, Derek. And that's what he is. Derek Morgan is a bully. Like, we've always said that about the character. But here is just, like, this the way everyone laughs off his bullying. It's really troubling.
Yeah. It's terrible. It's another, as I say, I keep thinking now when I said last week that the show has no moral center and that's one of its real problems.
Especially moving as it moves forward.
Yeah. And it's going to get worse and worse and worse.
Oh, yeah.
So
again, there's this funny moment in the show where they're like, this is much later. We'll talk about it later, where I'm like, you know, they talk about, you know, about murder. And I'm like, about, you know, whether Reed should feel the bad about stuff he did when he was in prison. I'm like, you've all murdered people. Every single member of this cast has murdered people. Has shot an unarmed person or the equivalent, right? Every single member of this cast. So whatever he did to survive in prison, you can't, like, no one can be upset about. But you're right. They've lost this moral center, right? That, like, whatever they had at the beginning, it's long gone now. And I think season 7 is when we're seeing that start to erode. Because it's not just the characters. It's the worldview of the show that's starting to feel bleak and amoral.
Yeah.
Like, it's the message of the show that this is all unpleasant, and it's going to stay unpleasant, and it's always going to be unpleasant.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, though, watching this develop.
No, it is. It wasn't always like this. Because you can, and again, it comes to the point that if we hadn't had suspect behavior in between, it might not have
noticed
been
it as starkly.
Quite as starkly.
Yeah.
No, I you think know, that it would have taken point. You a little bit longer to get there. But yeah.
No, that's a really good point. I think it is. Like, I think it is having suspect behavior in the middle to show you that you can be telling these stories in a more humane fashion.
Yes.
Right? And you're still telling the exact same kind of story, but you're doing it in this more humane fashion.
Well, just
this more people-focused fashion.
Well, I mean, you can think of a myriad of ways that that this show could have handled this episode differently.
Yeah. But no, they do it in one of the worst possible ways.
Yeah.
Ugh, it's so frustrating.
You know, like, because you've got this example of suspect behavior, and all you can do is, okay, how would the Red Cell team have handled this?
I know.
Very differently.
Oh, I imagine so. All right, so this is, like we said, this is not a good episode for a lot of reasons. But, yeah, I think that there's going to be other episodes that show more of the emotional, like, the bad emotional work that the show does, the bad worldview the show has. But this one is a prime example of just terrible police work, like, screwing up their chances. Speaking of terrible police work screwing up their ability to solve crimes, let's move on to the next episode.
From Childhood's Hour. When a 9-year-old St. Louis, Missouri boy goes missing and his troubled mother subsequently is murdered, the BAU searches for a killer who uses his profession to gain his victim's trust.
They actually don't find that out until the second kid goes missing and then is returned. They don't actually find out that that's, but you're right. I mean, maybe they're not saying they necessarily know that, but that is what the killer
is. No, what I would say is profiling doesn't really help them find, because what they have is the kid.
Yeah. The kid really just tells them that I called 911 and the guy I talked to on 911 came and kidnapped me.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, problem solved then. Let's just go get that guy.
Yeah. Problem solved. Let's find this guy and go get him.
Well, it's funny, because the first episode, I was saying that in the last, about the last episode, that they don't follow these people around. This woman's son gets kidnapped, and then they just leave her alone. Like, we've seen a lot of kidnappings on this show, and this is the first time I've ever seen it, where they just like, oh, well, let's just leave the mother alone. No, stay with the mother. A, what if the kidnapper calls? You know, it's like, A, B, there's a slight chance that she could be the real target and he's using the sun to get to her. But A, there's a large chance the kidnapper will reach out. In many cases, they do. Why are you leaving this woman alone? And the answer is, it's so she can get murdered. But there's no reason for the characters to leave her alone.
I know.
It's crazy. It's like, why are you leaving this woman alone? Like, you should be looking over her shoulder until you've actually located the criminal, right?
I know. Do I sound weary?
It's a bad episode, is my point.
Well, as I said, and it's not like Profiling helps them any.
No, it really doesn't. They literally just get told, oh, well, who
the
came
little
get you?
Kid.
They let
well,
the, they
Superman.
Let, he, yeah, Superman. What do you mean? Oh, well, I dial 911 and I get rescued.
Yeah.
Right? And there you go. He dials 911 and he gets rescued. And then we get the funniest line from Garcia, which is like, there are a quarter of a billion phone calls to 911 every year. Maybe it's a quarter of a trillion. It could be a quarter of a trillion. Then everyone in America would be making 100 911 calls a year, which is, that's okay. So it's definitely a quarter of a billion there, which actually means that that's less than one 911 call per person in the country a year, which actually doesn't seem that bad.
Well, from my perspective, what I would say about that one,
yeah,
right, is that yes, but they can isolate the 911 calls in the town where this is happening.
I know, that's why it's such a crazy line from Garcia. Where she's
in
like,
St. Louis, Missouri.
I know. It's such a crazy line from Garcia, because it's like, what does it matter how many calls there were nationwide? We're only dealing with calls made by the victims in this case in this city, which you can instantaneously check, because 911 legally has to keep records of those.
Yeah, so...
like, it's not hard to check at all. And then they act like you had to... and then it gets weirder, because they act... okay, well, we have to figure out... we'll have to profile who was on duty at the times when they would have likely called. No, you don't have to do that. You can literally just check, when did phone number X call 911, and which operator was it assigned to? Because yeah, guess what? All of those houses didn't call 911 all the time. Like, the son called 911 on his suicidal mother. The other son called the 911 on because of his mother's drug overdose, right? Those are concrete 911 calls coming from that house, each of those two houses, going to the same guy. You can check that instantaneously. You don't have to get a list of... what they do is they get a list of everyone who was on shift when those calls came in, and then was not on shift when the kidnappings happened, and then it's like four guys, and they're like, oh, well, one of them was abused as a child. It must be him. But it's like, there's no way you would even have to do that. Once they, FBI, oh my God, the FBI can check who made any 911 call in America and who picked up the other line. Period. Yeah. So the minute the guy says, I called 911 and then that guy came and got me, you would know exactly who the killer was. There would be no waiting around. There would be no trying to figure out. You would right away know who the killer was. And it really bothers me that for all of the time, they're pretending. They do this ridiculous stuff with Garcia where she comes up with magical abilities to find things. Here, they're actually making it seem like it's way harder than it would actually be in reality to find this guy.
Yes.
I know it shouldn't make me this mad.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, it's when we talk about it, profiling is not helping. The cast is clearly living in their own worlds and not interacting with one another. The writers are, I don't know what the template they've been given is.
Yeah, they are handed this format sheet, mm-hmm, of how every episode should look.
Yes, and we need to put another, you know, so then we have to, so I guess this is the next 2 weeks are Rossi's devastating moral dilemma.
Yeah,
because I forgot to watch read the rest of the thing, because I went, yes, well, they didn't find the killer because the kid came. But meanwhile, Rossi uncovers a stunning secret after reconnecting with his first wife.
I like, did you say discovers or uncovers?
Uncovers.
He doesn't uncover a secret. She just tells him what's going on.
Yeah. He doesn't uncover
a secret. No. Again, these are not the official synopses, but that's pretty bad. He doesn't uncover a secret. She just tells him, I have ALS and I'm going to be dying soon and I want you to help me out with that.
Yeah. Mine is going really, 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 really fast.
Yeah. And oof. And yeah. Here's something that really my takeaway from the episode was that it really does seem at the end of this episode like, oh, wow, that's putting David in a bind. And you wonder, how is that going to pay off? And is there anything more to say about this dire episode, or can we move on to the episode this week?
Yeah, oh, there's one more thing for me to say about this dire episode.
Please.
Okay. And that is that at the end, because, of course, it turns out that the boy has pushed his mother off the edge.
Right. Oh, God, I completely forgot to mention. Thank you for bringing this up.
That he killed his mother. There are a number of issues with this. He's clearly disturbed. Well, his mother was a very disturbed woman.
Many, many suicide attempts. And by the way, one of the things that really pissed me off in this episode where they're like, he definitely killed his mother because women don't jump off of things. I'm like,
what?
Women jump off of things. Bridges all the time. Bridges, buildings, small apartments. Women jump off of things all the time.
Yes.
What women don't do generally is shoot themselves.
Yeah.
But that's it. That is the only kind of suicide where you're like, oh, women probably wouldn't do that. No, women drive their cars off of things. Women poison themselves. Women, some women have set themselves on fire. Okay? They usually don't shoot themselves. That's true. But the idea that they can profile that he must have killed his mother because women don't jump off of things? That's just factually incorrect.
Yeah. And it infuriated me. And it infuriated me. It infuriated me the way they had Hotch handle it.
Oh, I know.
That is just infuriating. Particularly, as I said, if we had only not watched Suspect Behavior in between. And all I can think of is Sam would have done so much better with this.
I know.
Oh, and, God. I mean, now it's the writing, but it tells you something about the friggin' writing room.
Yep.
The writing room that existed on Suspect Behavior was a hell of a lot better than this writing room.
Oh, absolutely. Like, there's no questioning that.
Unbelievable. But that it's so obvious.
Yeah.
You know, that it just is, like, you can't walk away from it. It's just...
Yeah. No, yeah. It's all right. So detail why it especially pissed you off as compared to it. Like, what about the way they handled it really bothered you?
Okay, let me go back because I watched it on Wednesday, I think, because I watched the last one yesterday. So I must have watched it Wednesday night after I got home from work. What really pissed me off was the way that it's set up, that he talks about, you know, like, here's the kid talking about how his mother jumped off.
Yeah.
Or, you know, was happier.
Or yeah, she was finally happy when she died.
And then he looks at her, no. You know, it's just that abrupt, no, you pushed her off.
Yeah.
And it just bothered me, no.
Yeah. It's like, confronting him that way isn't going to accomplish anything.
Nothing. There was nothing here to be served by that. I mean, clearly he had created this narrative in his head and he's, you know, doing all of these horrible things. Not that I think that anything that he did is correct. That's not the
point. Of course not. You're not defending his actions.
No, you're not defending his actions. But my lord, his mother had committed suicide multiple times.
And attempted suicide multiple times.
Yeah, excuse me, yeah. Attempted.
And I suicide. Guess the big message in the episode is he finally helped her do what she'd been trying to do forever.
Yeah, and I mean that's basically, but of course he knows that it was wrong.
Of course.
Because otherwise he wouldn't be doing what he's doing now to justify what he did to his mother.
Oh yeah. I mean, the psychology of his actions,
yeah.
I would say makes sense. Because yeah. fundamentally, when you've done something this immoral, you then try to create a framework where it's okay, and that framework has transformed itself into this really elaborate serial killer thing.
Yeah.
Like, I actually totally buy this guy's motivation.
Yep.
In a way that, you know, the next one we're going to talk about is a little less,
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, the motivation here is fine, except that, so what are you trying to prove by having Hotch jump down
his kid's throat? Yeah.
And make it look like the kid, and what really pissed me off is that when you look at this, the kid is just helping his mother do what she tried to do all along.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And yet you have this attitude like somehow or another he was the bad seed and killed his mother out of the clear blue.
Like, the thing is,
looks at his face.
I know.
They pan onto this kid's face as if he's something evil. No.
And he's a monster. No. Like, here's the thing. And this is what's so horrible about the way they handle it. He had to say, he had to be, if he had been understanding in that moment, right? And said to the guy that you were a child and she convinced you that this was the right thing to do. That would be completely right. And it would have helped the guy surrender.
Yeah.
But it's like, just say, it's not your fault. Yes, we understand that you pushed her, but it was only because she had convinced you that that was what she was wanted, and she wasn't strong enough to do it herself.
So, yeah.
And that is what happened.
Yeah. And we know that Sam would have understood that way.
Yeah, absolutely would have.
Or the writers, let me put it this way, the writers on Suspect Behavior would have understood it this way.
Yes. And that's what's so frustrating about it is, obviously, that's the message you give to this kid. Is that, you know what, yeah, we know what the hell you went through. Yes, you pushed your mother and now you're trying to justify it, but it's not your fault. She created a situation. For the love of God, this woman had tried to kill herself. How many times?
I can't remember.
And she took her son on a walk and sat on the edge of a bridge.
Well, she didn't take him on the walk. He followed her.
No, they say he followed.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
They say he followed. I don't know if I believe that.
Yeah.
I'm more likely to believe the mother brought him in the hopes that he would do what he did.
Yeah.
Because come on. Really? He followed her?
Yeah.
Does that really seem like something a kid would do?
No.
No. She brought him in the hopes that what would happen happened.
Yeah.
Right? And it really bothers me that the team is so cruel in this situation.
Oh, this team. But
being
this team
understanding,
is becoming crueler by the week.
Yeah. And had they just been understanding in that situation, they would have gotten a better result and the guy would have, you know, surrendered more peacefully. And they do a little drive-by about mother's boyfriends who molest the daughters. Just throw that in there in passing.
Just do a drive-by, yeah.
A little drive-by in this horrible thing that really happens all the time. Just so weird to see that not be the focus of an episode, but just zip by that thing. Very weird. I mean, it's a big issue, and it's a, what do you call it? It's a terrifying issue, and it's just strange to see it just get the minorest shout-out as just an extra motivation for the last killing. Okay. All right, so obviously we had issues with this episode.
It was so wrong.
No, it is. It's wrong in a lot of ways. Is it as bad as the first three of this season we watched? No, of course not.
No, but, as I said, these episodes are better.
No, oh, they're definitely better. But the only one that's really interesting is the third one, because it's the payoff of the David Rossi story. And it opens up something interesting that I'll talk about as we go. But first, could you hit us with the synopsis, please?
The episode is called Epilogue. When the bodies of three drowning victims are found in Angeles National Forest, the BAU attempts to profile a killer determined to learn what happens after death. Meanwhile, Rossi contemplates whether or not he should carry out Carolyn's request.
Oof. All right.
Okay, so this is going to the well. And the thing, you know, just going to the well again. And the thing that infuriated me, shall I just say, about the thing that infuriated me about this, all of a sudden I just went, okay, so they've got the father again.
Yeah.
Did they get the same actor?
No, it's not Don. It's not Don Swayze again.
I know, but my good God, it might as well be Don Swayze.
Given the look they give him and the fact that they've given him.
Why didn't they just hire Don Swayze for the part?
And the fact that he looks so close, especially.
You know, but you know, it infuriated me, and partly because these molesters, these bastards,
child abusers,
all the rest of it, they want to make them look like they're some kind of horrible
monsters,
right? Whenever they get to the fathers, and that's again a difference that you see in suspect behavior, right? So here they get the same character. He's the same character.
He's exactly the same character as Tobias Henkel's dad.
Yeah,
I don't remember the father's name. But, I mean, and it's weird that he's so exactly the same character, especially when that gets mentioned in the episode. Like, they give a shout-out to that character in that episode, in this episode, forcing us to remind us of the strange casting choice they made. It's very weird. But yeah, you're right. Like, they have this thing where they show you... When they have the father, he tends to be like this abhorrent, monstrous, redneck type figure doing the abuse. Whereas abusive mothers can look like whatever.
Well, I'm just looking at like all of these and just going, you know, it really is it is so formulaic. You can see why people stopped watching. Like the whole, I mean, they went from a 13. I mean, they've got 13 million, 12, 13 million still in this
season. In this season every week.
Right? But eventually it's going to get.
It's
going to
get, yeah.
And so this is 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm just thinking, looking at that. But I mean, to go to that well and to just and make that father. You know,
to be the exact same character.
Exactly the same.
Like both visually and in behavior.
Yeah.
Right down to ending up giving his son a religious mania.
Yeah.
And it's a distinctly different religious mania than Tobias Henkel had. Yeah. But it is still religious mania caused by this kind of monstrous abuse.
Yeah. And so... You can only have this. I mean, I'm sorry, but most of the child abusing religious monsters that I have known in my life don't look like that.
Nope.
Not one of them.
And yet, when they had a chance to do it in Pleasure Is My Business, they didn't have the, you know, the rich religious guy have abused his daughter.
Yeah. Of course not.
Because they can't face up to the idea that, oh, yeah, maybe the upper class people do this too. Maybe the upper middle class people do this too. No, it's just the poor, you know, hillbilly types who create religious mania in their children through beating.
It was just, I mean, it was just a horrible.
No, it's insulting.
It's just insulting to the audience. And this episode across the board was, you know, okay, so he takes them and then he takes the mother and the son.
Okay, well, first off, here's what I love about this episode, and it goes back to like them focusing on the wrong things.
Of course. Where it's
like, because at the beginning of the episode, like literally, they have found three bodies in the water, right?
Yes.
And so another guy gets grabbed from the shore,
yes,
right? And they're like, but the new guy looks different and has a different hair color than the other three. Why would he have changed his victim type? And I'm like, it has to be significant, right? And I'm like, the guy was alone on a beach. Like,
yeah.
Why does it have to be more significant than that? Everybody else, you know, was out on the water. The guy was alone on the beach and apparently managed to drag him very far, like, without the cops finding him, which is kind of amazing.
Not only that, but without, his brother, who is rushing as fast as he can to get there.
I know.
And the guy gets away.
Dragging someone?
Yeah, they don't. And he's
also,
got
the guy is weak from leukemia? Like, the guy's weak from leukemia.
You know, and I'm just going,
I don't think so. Yeah, no. Also, why have they not closed down this lake? They just found three corpses.
Why are they allowing those people, those camper kids?
As they are finding three bodies, the killer shows up and murders somebody 50 feet away from where they were finding the three bodies. Yet for the rest of the day, all of the local water facilities are open and people are free to rent jet skis.
Yeah.
Like,
you know.
No! Shut
but
this place
not
down.
Not just that. No cops would allow those kids to be anywhere near that crime scene in their boat.
Yeah, like, why are they letting the boat get that close? Like, dude, you guys, A, now they're going to think you're involved. But B, you're definitely running the risk of disturbing evidence. Why are they letting you boat right up to there? It doesn't make any sense. Like, A, shut down the lake. There's a killer on the loose. But B, like, why are you letting them interfere with your crime scene? It's just ridiculous. No, it is deeply questionable.
You know,
and especially
in the 50s, that might have happened.
Yeah.
Right? That you could get that close, because with car wrecks and the rest of it.
Oh, yeah. People did that all the time.
You know, you could get that close.
But
this is not the 50s, and this is not the Hicks, and this is not, you know, yeah. I'm just like.
And seriously, though, who's even coming out to the forest to have a party day when there is a killer on the loose?
Yeah.
Like. And at least in Friday the 13th, part 3, they think Jason's dead. Sorry, part 4, they think Jason's dead, you know? So
at least they think Jason's dead.
In part 4, whereas here, like, literally 2 hours ago, a crazy man on this lake murdered somebody. And by the way, his plan of, I'll siphon the fuel out of one of their jet skis
so that they're going to land exactly where I want them to land.
And of course, I will know which direction they're going to go in, so I will be able to judge exactly where she runs out of fuel, and I will know that I'll be there waiting for her, and her friends definitely won't have been waiting around with her. This is the dumbest plan I've ever heard of. How does this plan work?
Well, it through the magic of whatever those horrible things they're seeing are.
Yeah.
That he saw when he was dead, supposedly.
So, okay, here's something I'm going to bring up about this episode. I think hell is real in the world of Criminal Minds. And I'll tell you why I think that.
I was just gonna say.
It seems like a leap. Okay, it seems like I'm making a leap to say that, but bear with me. I think hell is real in the world of Criminal Minds, and I'll tell you why. So we hear that Emily and this guy had the same vision of death, which is coldness, darkness, aloneness.
Yeah.
Right? And this guy is freaked out by that. What do you call it? Reed, we find out, had a more traditional, near-death experience.
Yeah.
Right? But they both had, these two people both had this very bleak thing. And you can back me up on this. Hell doesn't actually come up much in the Bible.
No.
It's basically not present in the Bible at all.
No.
In the Gospels, Jesus talks about hell one time, and it's the story of Lazarus and the rich man. And a rich man doesn't give money to Lazarus, a beggar. And when Lazarus dies, he goes to heaven. And the rich man dies, he goes to hell. Yeah. And the rich man says, you know, being so horrified, he says to God, send me back so I can warm my brothers. Right? I know I'm stuck here in hell. I know this is it for me. Send me back for one day so I can warn my brothers to be kind to the poor and be better people so they don't end up like me. And the response he gets is, I already sent Jesus to tell them that, and they didn't listen. What are you going to do? It's not a nice story.
Yeah, people forget the not nice stories that inhabit the world of the Bible.
I know. But the reason I bring it up is, and this is why what I think the writers are getting at is, hell is specifically referred to as a place of darkness and cold and loneliness.
Yeah.
That is where that comes from. And the fact that Emily and this guy had that same thing suggests that they're both going to hell. And on some level, Emily confirms that she's afraid of that because that was her experience when Ian briefly killed her. And she's afraid that she can't change things. If she can't change things, she's going to end up back there. So on some level, and I mean, this actually gets perverted in a later season, but it's interesting that within the world of the show, Emily suspects she's going to hell because of the stuff she's done in her life,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because she was raised Catholic, and because of the things she's done in her life, she's afraid she's going to hell. And yet Reed, who's not religious at all, and in fact thinks religious people are weak-minded, quite obviously.
Yep.
He's been very open about that over the course of the show. He, by comparison, he gets a pass. And I would make the argument that there's a good chance that it is, within the world of the show, no matter what Reed does, his upbringing was so traumatic, he has already been scoured of his sins. That is pre-happened for him.
Love it.
And that's why Reed gets out of hell.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me because they say it right there. And the fact that, like, they specifically use the reference to biblical hell, as in the one that's actually mentioned in the New Testament, suggests that in the same way that they hint over and over again that demons are real in this world, I guess heaven and hell are too. And I don't know if there's a lot of, like, there's not a ton of proof on this, but at the same time, between these couple of episodes, all the demonology stuff, and Elle also having that traditional near-death experience,
yeah,
it really does seem like in the world of the show, there is divine law.
Well, if there is divine law, these people are breaking it left, right, and
center. Well, we know Emily is because she's going to hell.
I don't know if Emily will go to hell, but Derek is hell. Well,
by the way, and I love how easy this. Oh, God, ouch. Oh, but here's something, and I do want to mention. It's like this is again them screwing up. Just day one police work stuff. A guy was drowned in the lake. Do we have any murderers living out in the lake? Beep, boop, beep, boop, boop. Oh, yeah, a guy lives in the lake. He murdered his dad by burying him alive. That's a lot like drowning. Maybe we should go check him out. You know what? You would have solved this crime a lot faster. Because don't tell me there are like 100 murderers living out on the lake that would have been hard to pour through. Because when they figure out that it's like someone who might have had a near-death experience, They go and they look into it, and they find this guy like that. He murdered his dad by burying him alive.
No, his dad buried him alive.
Oh, you're right. His dad married him alive,
and then he murdered his dad.
Yes. Then he clubbed his dad to death. You're right. I got it backwards. But the point is, the first thing you would check when there are bodies at the lake is, are there any known murderers who live by the lake? And the answer is yes, there is a known murderer who lives
and
by the lake.
And he's been discovered to have leukemia. And he's... Oh, I wonder if he's the guy that's doing this. Maybe we should go look for him.
Maybe we should go have an interview with this guy. Boom. The jet ski girl doesn't get killed. If they just decide to interview other murderers who live at the lake. Which, again, you'd think would be the first thing they would think to try.
Particularly since he had a religious mania.
I know, right? Oh, although they don't figure out the near-death experience part of the resuscitation ritual for a while. But just, like, your first thing you would think of when someone gets murdered at the lake is, are there any known murderers at the lake? That is just absolutely, logically, the first thing you do. And the fact that they don't makes them look terrible at their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, speaking of terrible people, can we talk about David Rossi?
What a fucking jerk. Sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean, you've described my opinion exactly.
No wonder she divorced him.
Of course. Well, no. Hey. They had a son who died?
Yes.
I totally forgot that. In childbirth. Oh, okay.
Yeah. The son died in childbirth.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I remembered it, but I went back and checked it, double checked it to make... Yeah, he was born and died on the same day.
Okay, I had totally forgotten that. Yeah. It's just interesting.
Yes, you don't see those things when you watch it at double speed.
I know. I'm terrible. 2.3 speed. Anyway.
That's even worse.
It's even worse. I get it. But no, David is... What adds insult to injury is that she says that she knew David wouldn't do it because he's the best guy she knows. And I'm like, yeah, he's not a good guy. The fact that the show tries to tell you that he puts, that he puts his own religious belief over someone else's pain and suffering is kind of proof that he's not a good person. And the fact that she uses that as her reason to believe that he is a good person feels insulting to me as I watch it. Like, no, he's not a good person. He's being selfish.
Yeah.
Because you know what? I hate to say it. He can help you commit suicide. And then he can go to confession the next day and be fine. But he's not willing to do this thing for her that she needs. David Rossi murders multiple people over the run of this show. Not just once or twice. Well, no, maybe just twice. I'm going to have to check more closely, and I'm not done the show yet. But David Rossi has murdered people. Not shot someone who was threatening a gun, blah, blah, blah. He has murdered people who were defenseless in the run of this show, okay? And the idea that it makes him a good person, that he wouldn't help someone with an assisted suicide, kind of sickens me.
Yeah.
It's arrogant and it's disgusting. And this is the moment I really turned on David Rossi.
Yeah.
And all the stuff I talk about what a bad person David Rossi is, as we do these reviews, I doubt all of that stuff is there when I watched the episodes I was talking about the first time, because I think this episode has forever altered my view of the character. And now when I go back and watch earlier stuff, I can't be as kind to him.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. No, it does when you go back and watch them a second time. Because you're getting a picture. As I said, there are some pretty consistent behavior. Like, it doesn't surprise me that he won't do it.
Yeah.
in the sense of his character, is got this black and white, and he follows the rules in this bizarre world that he lives in. He's egocentric. Yeah, well, yeah, but even then he finds ways of justifying it in his head.
Yeah. That's true.
Right? But it's not the same thing. It's always these bad people. His ex-wife, of course, he feels massively guilty because, of course, he screwed up her life. And who knows why the baby died? We don't know.
But he obviously, like, obviously they did, it, the marriage did not survive that child's death.
No. The marriage didn't survive it. Yeah. It couldn't possibly. I mean, he was never around anyway, I'm sure. I mean, I, you know, the marriage was probably not the greatest in the first place. And then.
Well, I mean, he ran off to France.
Yeah.
Right after. Like, he divorced this wife and he ran off to France the next minute. Yeah. He just ran away.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to guess who caused this marriage to not work after the death of the child, the fact that David ran off to France and married someone else immediately suggests that David was a lot of what was responsible here.
Well, yes, and you compare this to the loss of the child in the inside and how it's handled, right? Anyway, yeah. But this is, and then he doesn't go, well, he doesn't call 911. Well, she's already basically dead.
I know.
And so he does, while he doesn't actively, he puts off calling 911. He does do this for her.
Yeah.
In the end. Kind of. Well, kind of. Like, he doesn't help her. He doesn't help her.
He doesn't approve of what she's doing. She goes out experiencing moral judgment from David Rossi.
Yeah.
That is the last thing she experiences before dying. David Rossi's moral judgment.
Yeah. So, but then you could say, well, why the hell did she go to him in the first place?
That's a really good question. Why did she think? Because she says she knows he wouldn't have helped.
Well, yes, but that's a lie.
You're right. That's a lie. She hoped he would.
That's
help.
A Look lie.
At, you're she right. Went you're to absolutely him because right. That's a justification at the end. And by the way, how bad is it that lies like that to make him feel better?
Yeah.
God, what a terrible marriage they must have had.
Well, it's what women do.
No, you're right.
We do it all the time.
Tell lies like this to make men feel better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a Terry Clark song called Girls Lie Too, which is really, really funny. But anyway.
But it's an upsetting scene. Like, it really is, because David is so weak. And he's so, like, I mean, in a sense, callous to her needs.
Yeah. But he's...
And I just find it troubling.
Yes, but he's a self-involved, narcissistic man.
That's true.
And has always been that way. You know, I mean, this just follows up on Hotch forcing him to have people over to his house.
Yeah, it is.
You know, for a spaghetti dinner. He's not engaged with these people, like this whole stupid thing. I mean, this is where it's starting to really piss me off, this idea that this is a family. If this is a family, this is not just a dysfunctional family. This is a really bad family structure.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know, you've got the bully who bullies his little brother, who's finally getting big enough to get back at him. The women are kind of relegated to... What are they?
Secondary positions.
Secondary positions. That's the best. I mean.
And that's the nicest way to put it.
And Hotch was certainly not a good husband.
No.
At all. That it has forced him, his wife's death has forced him to become a good father. But ultimately he wasn't a good father either.
Nope. No. And I mean, the thing is.
He didn't show up for doctor's appointments.
I know.
The whole thing.
It's interesting that, like, the best member of this family is Aaron. And even he's not a great dad of this family. Because, in a sense, like, he does provide a stabilizing influence. But he has this, like, he does not step in when he should.
And he doesn't stop Derek from being such an asshole.
That's what I'm saying. Like, he doesn't step in and lay down the law as much as he should as the boss of this team and the dad of this surrogate family.
Yeah, and the and even with Penelope. Look, Penelope, enough.
Yeah.
Enough of this Derek crap.
Yeah. This is not professional behavior.
And we don't
want to see it. And it's not helping anything, and it's certainly not helping you.
No. No.
His obsession with Derek isn't helping your life any. No, and it's just distraction to everyone on the team, so knock it off.
Yeah.
But we're gonna have more to say over the coming seasons about how the show treats the Derek Penelope relationship.
Oh, have
in
you
ways
come
that we don't approve of.
Oh, did you come to the when they had to go into a
Oh no, that's seasons and seasons ago when they had to do workplace behavior.
Well, it's not. This is season 7. So what was it? Season 9?
Something like that. Yeah. 8, 9 or 10, somewhere in there. Probably 9.
And maybe.
Yeah. So we'll get there soon enough, but it's troubling. There's plenty of stuff wrong with this family is the point.
Yeah. This is a dysfunctional. Really is. The family is as dysfunctional as the writing team appears to be. So.
Jesus.
You know.
We're not going to debate that point, but wow. That's.
The writing team, I mean, obviously what we're seeing, right, is this dysfunction. It's like these different people can, you know, have this idea. Because they must still write together, even though one person is responsible.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, the room gets together and they break all of the season stories. And then people go off and write them. Generally is how these things work.
Yeah, but they break. You know? But, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but generally the way things work doesn't necessarily
always apply in this type of show. I know. You're absolutely right.
Given its inconsistencies and given its problems. And no, I mean the Rossi character Joe Mantegna does a good job of trying to make him sympathetic, but he's being torn. Well, what he should have then made this thing made this upfront statement, I can't do it because I'm a Catholic.
Yeah.
Why didn't he just come out and have him say that?
And then at least
would have been, and his wife should have known better.
Yeah.
Than to ask him.
Yeah. And the thing is, I don't say you're right that had he just said it's because he's a Catholic. I don't know that it would have 100% let him off the hook.
Well, no, it wouldn't have.
But
we're not going to let him off the hook.
No, we're not going to let him off the hook at all. But it would have at least, right? It would have at least, like, given him some justification for doing this horrible thing.
Yeah, it would have mitigated.
That's true, yes. Mitigated is definitely the word I was looking for.
Yeah,
you.
That's the word you're looking for, you know? And then, because from my perspective, I still don't know why she went to him.
So can we talk about an episode of television that handles this a million times better?
Oh, sure, if you want to. I'm sure our listeners can continue.
Might appreciate that. So you know that The Mentalist is one of my favorite TV shows, right?
Yes, we know The Mentalist is one of your favorite TV
shows. I talk about The Mentalist a lot. I think it's a great TV show. And it's not just because of my love for stage magic. I think I think stage magic, close-up magic, is one of the greatest things humans do. Like I think magicians are like one of our most noble professions because they are actively trying to fill the world with magic. And I don't understand fiction's desire to pretend that magicians aren't the best thing in the world. Like, everyone in fiction seems to pretend that that everyone on Earth doesn't love magicians. And it took me years to figure out why this was. And it's that writers are jealous. No, it's true. The only people who don't like magicians are writers, and that's because writers on some level know that if they spent the amount of time, because magicians are all nerdy weirdos too, just like writers, but they do very well for themselves. They marry supermodels. They make millions of dollars, and they're nerdy weirdos, just like
writers
are. And writers sit there and they think, "Oh my God, if all this time I spent learning to write and obsessing over my books and my TV shows and my spec scripts and my novels, all right, if I had just spent that learning card tricks, I would have a happy, successful life. And they get so unbelievably jealous about that, they insert in their writing that, like, magicians are uncool and nobody likes magic. Where it's like, everyone on Earth likes magic. I've never met anyone who doesn't like magic tricks. Have you ever met anyone who doesn't like magic tricks?
No.
No. It's never happened in your real life that you've come across someone who isn't delighted by card tricks and sleight of hand. That's human. It is literally.
It's always amazing that people can.
No, I mean, it's like, I watch it, and someone who's been obsessed with this from a child, I can watch, and 90% of the time, I can tell you how somebody did a trick, but it doesn't make me enjoy the trick any less, because I love the performance aspect, and I love that they're able to pull it off. So I love magic, and the fact that The Mentalist was a show about a magician made me really happy. But, that being said, it was a great show, because it was a show that was about a character's fascinating journey.
Yes.
Okay? And it is about an incredibly complicated character going through a ton of stuff. And it's all filtered through his... No, it's awful. But it's all focused... No, it's horrible what Patrick Jane goes through. It's an amazing story. It's an amazing show. But there is an episode where the recurring character medical examiner is like David's wife in this episode, dying of a degenerative disease and has just weeks left.
Yeah.
And he needs someone. And what he explains is he has asked Patrick to come and be there and support him in that. Not because they're friends, not because he thinks that Patrick's a good person, but because if a state agent is there when he dies, he won't have to have an autopsy, and he can't bear the thought of him having an autopsy done on him. And he knows that Patrick is the only person he could ask who wouldn't try to talk him out of it.
Yeah.
And it is a beautiful scene. It is a surprisingly touching scene, and it is so more deftly handled.
Yeah.
Than this episode of Criminal Minds, that I hated this episode of Criminal Minds more than I would have because I've recently rewatched The Mentalist.
Ah, yes.
It's like seeing that David makes her passing as painful and emotionally wrenching as possible.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Rather than just sucking it up.
Yeah, and just
swallowing his pride.
Yeah.
And just doing the right thing by her. You are right. You are 100% right that she never should have come to David with this.
Yeah.
Because he's not a good person. And he is a narcissist. Right? And he is egotistical. Like, you're right that she never should have gone to him with this. But this was his moment. This was his chance to, like, do right by her for the first time.
Yeah.
And he still couldn't do it. And, I mean, and this is my question to you. Maybe you understand this better than I do. What do the writers think we're supposed to feel about David after he does this? Are we supposed to believe her when she says he's the best person?
I think so. I think that the writers think that suicide is wrong.
Yeah.
I think they have a moral position about suicide, and suicide is wrong. And
right.
so they have David tempted. to help her do this, but that, yeah, no, he's a good person, and they have to have her say it because they, of course, have to. Well, because
you know,
people like us aren't going to buy it for one minute.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah. No, I think that that's it. They had to have.
Oh my God! I just realized something.
What?
You know, we just stumbled ass backwards into.
What?
Think about it. Suicide is wrong. It is the ultimate moral failing. I think you're right that they've proven that, because in this episode, we were joking earlier about how Reed's lifetime of suffering has guaranteed him a place in heaven.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's all the same moral theory.
Yeah.
that because suicide is inherently, like, it's coming from the same, more like, that offhanded line about Reed having a traditional near-death experience, being looked after by God in whatever, you know, way you want to shake that out and define that, right, is the same, it's operating under the same kind of moral theory that they want to say that suicide is always wrong, and the moral thing to do is die in unbelievable agony
and
after 3 months. Like, die horribly when your body shuts down after 3 months to 5 months of unbearable agony.
Yeah. It's not
that,
like,
is the moral thing to do.
Yeah. As I said, she, it's not like she's, what's his face? You know, Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, Stephen Hawking, right. No. Oh.
And because ALS, like so many other of those diseases, you know, has
many variants and many ways it treats people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, her whole body is going to shut down. And I mean, it's going to be horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And the show's point of view, it is that it is more moral to go through that than it is to just end her suffering then and go out on her own terms.
Okay, so I guess they can justify doing the horrible things that they do to these women in these writing rooms, because the more horribly these women suffer,
they're guaranteed a place in heaven.
They're guaranteed a place in heaven. Yeah. Okay, Jesus. So that's its moral center. Well, we can now understand why I have no use for that moral center.
Fuck. Well, you know, it's the what do you call it? It's the Mother Teresa thing, you know? Like, they're suffering in life. That brings them closer to God.
Of course, I know. Have you read the chapter in my dissertation?
Of course I've read the chapter in your dissertation. Where do you think I get all this nonsense? You know, St. Maria Goretti? Did I ever tell you that St. Maria Goretti came up in a Kevin Smith movie?
No, really?
Yeah. No, it's hilarious. And it's like, it's a joke that is only for, like, 8 Catholics in the audience who would actually be watching a Kevin Smith movie. In questionable movie Jersey Girl, Ben Affleck's daughter is going to St. Maria Goretti Catholic school.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
And I'm like, that's so brutal!
Yeah, there are
and
so
no many. One watching this, no one watching this movie has any idea how brutal that is.
Yeah.
And if you want to know what we're talking about, St. Maria Goretti is not a famous saint. Google that. We're not going to get into the story here. It's too upset.
Yeah.
But you can Google why she's a saint, and you will be upset.
Yeah, or read. There's a whole section in my dissertation.
Oh, no, you can always read her dissertation, which is online, that gets into it. But it's like, literally, all you have to do is Google it and find out.
It's easy to read. It's easy to read. It's not.
No, yeah, it reads fantastically. I've always said that. But yeah, it's,
God.
It's troubling. And troubling is the nicest way to put it.
Okay, now what is the position of the Church of Scientology on suicide?
I don't know. I know nothing about the Church of Scientology.
No, neither. Okay.
It's probably that the Thetans in your body overwhelmed you. You know? You were overwhelmed by the Thetans in your body. And they caused you to end your life. But it's like, here's the thing. This isn't going to come up much else in the show. So it's our position is clear. We're not encouraging suicide. We really aren't. I think that I just want to make it clear, because it can sound like we are fine with suicide whenever, and we're absolutely not, because it is bad in the previous episode that woman put her, like, didn't have the guts to commit suicide and made her son do it for her, right? That's bad. But by comparison, it's not bad that this woman wanted to end her life to avoid this kind of agony. And I know that people cure diseases all of the time, and there's that horrible thing in Star Trek V where we find out that McCoy feels guilty because he euthanized his dad, and then, like, 6 months later, they found a cure for his dad's horrible condition. But, you know, that's getting into the weeds. The fact is, if people... I'm not saying euthanize people who are in agony. I'm saying that if someone decides that because of physical... not an emotional pain, because that's curable, but because of physical determination, they want to go out on their own terms, I personally am fine with that.
So Terry Pratchett,
Canadian government is. Terry Pratchett went out on his own terms. Because just as the Alzheimer's started getting bad, he's like, I'm going out now before it gets really bad. And Terry Pratchett is a smarter person than any of us. He was Terry Pratchett. But what it comes down to is, and I can't stress this enough, like, we don't want to make it seem like we're treating suicide glibly. If you are having emotional troubles, there is always help for that.
Yeah.
Right? And suicide is never the answer to horrible emotional situations, which it's terrible because suicide is most used as a response to emotional situations, not as a response to physical situations. And if we could get it down to suicide only being used over physical stuff, that would be a giant win for everybody. Yeah. But I think it's terrible when people try to create this suicide is never the answer message. And the answer is, well, you know, you've never been dying of a degenerative disease.
No.
But the fact is, when it comes to emotional stuff, when it comes to personal stuff, when it comes to your life, no, I don't know that suicide ever is the answer.
Well, I mean, my line would be, yeah, suicide, I don't know. I mean, it's funny, eh? Because in Holland, they do allow sort of for emotional...
Yeah, depression-based suicide.
Anorexia.
Yeah. You can get a doctor to sign off on your suicide for extreme emotional distress. And I really don't agree with that, although I haven't read all of the issues. So I will admit it is a visceral disagreement.
Yeah, well, the thing is that it is so difficult because, you know, I don't like slippery slope arguments at all.
Oh, of course.
But it's who makes those decisions that are so difficult, right?
Well, do you know what my telling thing is? The thing that is always the reason I think that you can always come back from stuff is that I have read I read this long article about it, and then I watched that movie about the people who jump off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah.
And the takeaway was, and this is what fascinated me about it, and the horrifying thing about it is that, you know, a tiny percentage of the people who jump off the Golden Gate Bridge survive.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, every single person who jumps off the bridge and survives describes the fact that on the way down, they immediately regretted their decision and realized that they should not, like, that this was a mistake, whatever their problem was, it is resolvable.
Yeah, and when you
And then you have to extrapolate, oh, then probably all the people who died thought that too when they were jumping off.
Well, no, and I do think I don't have any question that people do regret. It is sometimes though when you see people doing it again and again, yeah, and again, and then I'm going, okay, but I will tell you, I know what some of the problem is, and like, because we're talking about the difference between physical, because as I said, if I get
ceaseless agony,
Alzheimer's, shoot me. You know, yeah.
No, the ceaseless physical and mental agony.
The mental agony of Alzheimer's is something people haven't ever really, or are only beginning to acknowledge.
Yeah.
But it's not like my mother didn't know. It's not like my father-in-law didn't know. Didn't know. Now, it's not like they knew all the time.
No, but they have moments of clarity where they're understanding what's happening to them.
And they just, you know, as you know, my father-in-law screaming at God to take him. You know, yeah, just screaming in the middle of the night. He wanted to die. You know, and that isn't an option. HIV before you had the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of those issues, because it's a horrible, horrible, horrible disease to die from, for I would say most people who develop AIDS, who go on to develop AIDS. I don't know if we're going to see that, if they're always going to manage. Never mind. I don't want to get into the retrovirus. I don't want to get into that. The emotional stuff, though, you know, you really wonder, but they don't have places. And the problem is that because, depression and so many of these things come from family dynamic.
Which yeah, there's no support awful. For them. Yeah, you're right. It's like, how are these people going to have support to get better if it's their family that's causing them this causing this depression?
That the family and the rest of it, there's something integral in the early days. They don't get the proper help. For a lot of reasons. I could give you a lot of reasons, but the classic example of this was. I mean, my mother ran the psychiatric ward, was the supervisor. She taught psychiatric nursing and stuff and at the ward in the Sioux. And
Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, just for people who don't know.
In the Sioux, yeah. But
so what people, this is how people from Sault Ste. Marie talk. They expect everyone knows what they mean.
Yeah, the Sioux. Well, people from Sioux, Michigan, too, do that, right?
I know.
But anyway, never mind. But there was this one woman, and so didn't hear this from my mother,
okay,
because Sault Ste. Marie is a small town. But she lived next door to my best friend. And anyway, but once a year, she would go into the hospital, into the psychiatric ward, like she would break down so completely she'd be in the... I guess she would attempt suicide. She must have been depressed. Oh. I don't know what. And she would end up in the psychiatric ward for six weeks.
Yeah.
Well, why? Because you pump her full of drugs and the rest of it. And then guess what? She gets sent back home.
Yeah. So, and all of the stuff that caused her and brought her there.
Yeah. You know, she was older, right? So it was the husband and the kids and the, heaven knows if she, you know, I mean, I don't know all the details because we were only teenagers, but it was like the big secret on that particular street. Right?
Yeah. It was this woman who always had this annual breakdown.
Yeah. And would end up, once there was a psychiatric ward, would end up in the hospital. And then would just go right back. And
I think you make a good point. Like, when the problems, because we as a society... so expect the family to deal with all this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, what the hell do you do when the family's the problem?
Yeah.
You know?
And particularly
in a society. There's no apparatus designed to intervene and help those people.
Yeah. When do you intervene, right? When are you allowed to intervene? We've already seen that. Well, of course.
Well, we're going back to
that, but that was on Suspect Behavior.
Suspect Behavior, the Smother episode. Yeah. It's like, when are we allowed to come in? So I hope we haven't depressed you too much with this bonus 20 minutes about suicide at the end of the episode. But I mean, honestly, I don't know how we could have avoided talking about it, given how fundamentally this episode defines how you have to look at David Rossi as a person.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to make it clear that we're not coming at this from nowhere. We're not looking for reasons to be mad at David Rossi, but he is terrible in this episode. He is terrible. And the rest of the show, it makes you look at all of the other little ways he's terrible. And spoiler alert, there's a lot of them.
They will come up. Well, two, and we already saw them. To his laughing when Derek decides to quote unquote prank.
Yeah.
Reed.
Yeah.
You know.
It's the exact same. It's all toxic behavior from David Rossi. David Rossi's a bad person. Is if there's one thing we'd like you to take away from this episode of television, it's that David Rossi is a bad person.
Yes, he's not someone you can count on in your life.
No, never.
Let me put
ever,
it
ever.
this way. And I do think that probably with the dead child, that the reason she went to him was somehow or another, she had idealized.
Yeah. Because of the agony they had gone through together. Well, no, I mean,
And that's a natural story.
Let's face it, the greatest sadness in her life is losing that kid, and she wants to go out with the only other person who can share that with her.
Yeah.
That's why she goes to David. And the fact that David can't be there for her just shows you, oh, well, then you definitely weren't there for her when she lost the kid either, were you?
Were you? No, and so then he goes and has a glass, what, does he have a glass of wine with her at the end?
Yeah. So it's,
Oh, yes, and that, of course, is taken from an episode of Miami Vice, the one called Birthday.
Oh, God.
That whole scene at the end.
It's very similar.
It's similar.
I'm not going to say it's a ripoff, but I will agree with you that it's similar. And before we go, I just want to, can we all just take a moment and think of that beautiful moment in Hannibal when Gina Torres has decided to kill herself?
Ah, yes.
And Hannibal has to decide whether he abides by his patient wishes and screws up his relationship with Jack Crawford, or calls Jack Crawford and betrays his doctor-patient confidentiality, his doctor-patient oath. And so he flips a coin. Because for whatever it's worth, Hannibal takes his duties as a therapist seriously.
I mean, that's what, as they say, it's the bizarrest parts of that character.
Of that character. So yeah, in that version of the character, he really does take it seriously. He has an oath to abide by her wishes in this situation, and he knows she's right, but it's too valuable having Jack Crawford on his side since he's a serial killer, so...
Yeah.
Coin flip. It's an amazing show. All right, so we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks for joining us for these three episodes. What are we going to be watching next week? This is your homework if you're watching along with us. Episodes 7 through 9, which are...
There's No Place Like Home.
Oh, God, the Frankenstein tornado episode. Okay.
Hope.
What's next?
Hope.
Don't remember which one that is. And the third one?
That's Garcia's victim support group.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, there you go. Okay.
And then Self-Fulfilling Prophecy.
Oh, all right. I can't promise anything for sure, but there's a good chance we're going to have a very, very fun next week's episode.
Yeah. Some of those are, I haven't seen them
there's
again.
There's definitely stuff worth talking about there. Again, the first one's a Franken. It's the most ludicrous premise they have done up until this point. Is the next episode.
Well, yeah, but that one, I mean, it's just fun.
No, it's fun. It's totally fun. But it's like, there's two different episodes of Criminal Minds about werewolves.
Yeah.
And yet, the one where a guy chases storms to throw corpses into tornadoes is the craziest, dumbest thing they've ever done.
Yes, thank God for tornadoes, right?
Okay. I know, right? All right, so meet us back here next week for that. We hope, given how much we talk about it, that you're also joining us every Monday for Criminal Minds Suspect Behavior Bonusodes. So please join us for those, since we're really proud of them. We're really happy with how our look back at that show went. And if you haven't already watched that show, listen to the episodes and try to understand why we're so obsessed with it, which is, it really is what Criminal Minds could have and should have been, rather than the show that it is.
Yeah,
I think is the simplest way to describe it. So, if you have any questions for us, if you have any comments, if you'd like to suggest any profiling-related fiction we should check out, I think you should drop us a line over at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. Obviously, we would love to hear from you. We will see you back here on Monday for Suspect Behavior and next Thursday for those episodes of Criminal Minds. But until then, I'd like to say au revoir.
And good night.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.